looked at me and said nothing. And I said in my head, "What kind of an idiot are you to be giving away your raisin?" Mr. Benson gave me a look and said nothing. And Nellie Ahern said, "You're a great old Yankee, Frankie." The priest will come soon to examine us on the catechism and everything else. The Master himself has to show us how to receive Holy Communion. He tells us, gather round him. He fills his hat with the limerick leader, torn into little bits. He gives Paddy Clossy the hat, kneels on the floor, tells Paddy to take one bit of paper and place it on his tongue. He shows us how to stick out the tongue, receive the bit of paper, hold it a moment, draw in the tongue, fold your hands in prayer, look towards heaven, close your eyes in adoration, wait for the paper to melt in your mouth, swallow it, and thank God for the gift, the sanctifying grace wafting in on the odor of sanctity. When he sticks out his tongue, we have to hold in the laugh because we never saw a big purple tongue before. He opens his eyes to catch the boys who are giggling, but he can't say anything because he still has God on his tongue, and it's a holy moment. He gets off his knees and tells us kneel around the classroom for the Holy Communion practice. He goes around the room, placing bits of paper on our tongues and mumbling in Latin. Some boys giggle, and he roars at them that if the giggling doesn't stop, it's not Holy Communion they'll be getting, but the last rites. And what is that sacrament called, McCourt? Extreme unction, sir. That's right, McCourt. Not bad for a Yank from the sinful shores of America. He tells us we have to be careful to stick out our tongues far enough so that the communion wafer won't fall to the floor. He says, that's the worst thing that can happen to a priest. If the wafer slides off your tongue, that poor priest has to get down on his two knees, pick it up with his own tongue, and lick the floor around it in case it bounds from one spot to another. The priest could get a splinter that would make his tongue swell to the size of a turnip, and that's enough to choke you and kill you entirely. He tells us that next to a relic of the true cross, the communion wafer is the holiest thing in the world, and our first communion is the holiest moment in our lives. Talking about first communion makes the Master all excited. He paces back and forth, waves his stick, tells us we must never forget that the moment the Holy Communion is placed on our tongues, we become members of that most glorious congregation, the one Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church, that for 2,000 years men, women and children have died for the faith, that the Irish have nothing to be ashamed of in the martyr department. Haven't we provided martyrs galore? Haven't we bared our necks to the Protestant axe? Haven't we mounted the scaffold singing, as if embarking on a picnic? Haven't we, boys? We have, sir. What have we done, boys? Bared our necks to the Protestant axe, sir, and mounted the scaffold singing, sir, as if embarking on a picnic, sir. He says that perhaps in this class there's a future priest or a martyr for the faith, though he doubts it very much. For we are the laziest gang of ignoramuses it has ever been his misfortune to teach. But it takes all kinds, he says, and surely God had some purpose when he sent the likes of ye to infest this earth. Surely God had a purpose when among us he sent Clossy with no shoes, Quigley with his damnable questions, and McCourt, heavy with sin from America. And remember this, boys. God did not send his only begotten Son to hang on the cross so that ye can go round on your first communion day with the paws clutching for the collection. Our Lord died so that ye might be redeemed. It is enough to receive the gift of faith. Are ye listening to me?
We are, sir.
And what's enough?
The gift of faith, sir.
Good. Go home.
At night, three of us sit under the light pole at the top of the lane, reading. Mikey, Maliki, and I. The Malloys are like us with their father drinking the dole money of the wages and leaving no money for candles or paraffin oil for the lamp. Mikey reads books, and the rest of us read comic books. His father, Peter, brings books from the Carnegie Library so that he'll have something to do when he's not drinking pints or when he's looking after the family any time Mrs. Malloy is in the lunatic asylum. He lets Mikey read any book he likes, and now Mikey is reading this book about Cahoolan and talking as if he knows everything about him. I want to tell him I knew all about Cahoolan when I was 3 going on 4, that I saw Cahoolan in Dublin, that Cahoolan thinks nothing of dropping into my dreams. I want to tell him, stop talking about Cahoolan. He's mine. He was mine years ago when I was young. But I can't because Mikey reads us a story I never heard of before, a dirty story about Cahoolan, which I can never tell my father or mother, the story of how Aymer became Cahoolan's wife. Cahoolan was getting to be an old man of 21. He was lonely and wanted to get married, which made him weak, says Mikey, and got him killed in the end. All the women in Ireland were mad about Cahoolan, and they wanted to marry him. He said that would be grand. He wouldn't mind marrying all the women of Ireland. If he could fight all the men of Ireland, why couldn't he marry all the women? But the king, Conor MacNessa, said, "That's all very well for you, Coo, but the men of Ireland don't want to be lonely in the far reaches of the night." The king decided there would have to be a contest to see who would marry Cahoolan, and it would be a pissing contest. All the women of Ireland assembled on the plains of Mortemna to see who could piss the longest. And it was Emer. She was the champion woman pisser of Ireland and married Cahoolan. And that's why to this day she's called Great Bladdered Emer. Mikey and Malachy laugh over this story, though I don't think Malachy understands it. He's young and far from his first communion, and he's only laughing over the piss word. Then Mikey tells me I've committed a sin by listening to a story that has that word in it, and when I go to my first confession, I'll have to tell the priest. Malachy says, "That's right, piss is a bad word, and you have to tell the priest because 'tis a sin word." I don't know what to do. How can I go to the priest and tell him this terrible thing in my first confession? All the boys know what sins they're going to tell, so that they'll get the first communion and make the collection and go to see James Cagney and eat sweets and cakes at the Lyric Cinema. The Master helped us with our sins, and everyone has the same sins. I hit my brother, I told a lie, I stole a penny from my mother's purse, I disobeyed my parents, I ate a sausage on Friday. But now I have a sin no one else has. And the priest is going to be shocked and drag me out of the confession box into the aisle, and out into the street where everyone will know I listened to a story about Cahoolan's wife being the champion woman pisser in all Ireland. I'll never be able to make my first communion, and mothers will hold their small children up and point at me and say, "Look at him, he's like Mikey Malloy, never made his first communion, wandering around in a state of sin, never made the collection, never saw James Cagney." I'm sorry I ever heard of First Communion and the collection. I'm sick, and I don't want any tea or bread or anything. Mam tells Dad it's a strange thing when a child won't have his bread and tea, and Dad says, "Ach, he's just nervous over the First Communion." I want to go over to him and sit on his lap and tell him what Mikey Malloy did to me, but I'm too big to be sitting on laps. And if I did, Malachy would go out in the lane and tell everyone I was a big baby. I'd like to tell my troubles to the angel on the seventh step, but he's busy bringing babies to mothers all over the world. Still, I'll ask Dad. "Dad, does the angel on the seventh step have other jobs besides bringing babies?" "He does." "Would the angel on the seventh step tell you what to do if you didn't know what to do?" "Ach, he would, son, he would. That's the job of an angel, even the one on the seventh step." Dad goes for a long walk. Mam takes Michael and goes to see Grandma. Malachy plays in the lane, and I have the house to myself so that I can sit on the seventh step and talk to the angel. I know he's there, because the seventh step feels warmer than the other steps, and there's a light in my head. I tell him my troubles, and I hear a voice. "Fear not," says the voice. He's talking backwards, and I tell him I don't know what he's talking about. Do not fear, says the voice. Tell the priest your sin, and you'll be forgiven.
Next morning I'm up early and drinking tea with Dad and telling him about the angel on the seventh step. He places his hand on my forehead to see if I'm feeling all right. He asks if I'm sure I had a light in my head and heard a voice, and what did the voice say? I tell him the voice said, "Fear not," and that means, "Do not fear." Dad tells me the angel is right, I shouldn't be afraid, and I tell him what Michael Malloy did to me. I tell him all about great bladder Emmer, and I even use the piss word because the angel said, "Fear not." Dad puts down his jam jar of tea and pats the back of my hand. "Ach, ach, ach," he says. And I wonder if he's gone demented like Mrs. Malloy, in and out of the lunatic asylum. But he says, "Is that what you were worried about last night?" I tell him it is. And he says it's not a sin, and I don't have to tell the priest. "But the angel on the seventh step said I should." "All right. Tell the priest if you like, but the angel on the seventh step said that only because you didn't tell me first. Isn't it better to be able to tell your father your troubles, rather than an angel who's a light and a voice in your head?" "'Tis, Dad." The day before First Communion, the Master leads us to St. Joseph's Church for First Confession. We march in pairs, and if we so much as move a lip on the streets of Limerick, he'll kill us on the spot and send us to hell, bloated with sin. That doesn't stop the bragging about the big sins. Willie Harold is whispering about his big sin, that he looked at his sister's naked body. Paddy Hartigan says he stole 10 shillings from his aunt's purse and made himself sick with ice cream and chips. Question Quigley says he ran away from home and spent half the night in a ditch with 4 goats. I tried to tell them about Cahoolin and Aymer, but the Master catches me talking and gives me a thump on the head. We kneel in the pews by the confession box, and I wonder if my Emerson is as bad as looking at your sister's naked body, because I know now that some things in the world are worse than others. That's why they have different sins, the sacrilege, the mortal sin, the venial sin. Then the Masters and grown-up people in general talk about the unforgivable sin, which is a great mystery. No one knows what it is. And you wonder how you can know if you've committed it, if you don't know what it is. If I tell a priest about Great Bladder Emmer and the pissing contest, he might say, "That's the unforgivable sin," and kick me out of the confession box, and I'll be disgraced all over Limerick and doomed to hell, tormented forever by devils who have nothing else to do but stab me with hot pitchforks till I'm worn out. I try to listen to Willie's confession when he goes in, but all I can hear is a hissing from the priest. And when Willie comes out, he's crying. It's my turn. The confession box is dark, and there's a big crucifix hanging over my head. I can hear a boy mumbling his confession on the other side. I wonder if there's any use trying to talk to the angel on the seventh step. I know he's not supposed to be hanging around confession boxes, but I feel the light in my head, and the voice is telling me, "Fear not." The panel slides back before my face, and the priest says, "Yes, my child. Blessed be Father, for I have sinned. This is my first confession." "Yes, my child. And what sins have you committed?" "I told a lie. I hit my brother. I took a penny from my mother's purse. I said a curse." "Yes, my child. Anything else?" I listened to a story about Cahoolin and Emmer." "Surely that's not a sin, my child. After all, we are assured by certain writers that Cahoolin turned Catholic in his last moments, as did his king, Conor MacNessa. 'Tis about Emmer, Father, and how she married him." "How was that, my child?" "She won him in a pissing contest." There's heavy breathing. The priest has his hand over his mouth, and he's making choking sounds and talking to himself. "Mother of God. Who told you that story, my child?" "Mikey Malloy, Father." "And where did he hear it?" "He read it in a book, Father." "Ah, a book.
Books can be dangerous for children, my child. Turn your mind from those silly stories and think of the lives of the saints. Think of St. Joseph, the little flower, the sweet and gentle St. Francis of Assisi, who loved the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Will you do that, my child?
I will, Father.
Are there any other sins, my child?
No, Father.
For your penance, say 3 Hail Marys, 3 Our Fathers, and say a special prayer for me.
I will. Father, was that the worst sin?
What do you mean?
Am I the worst of all the boys, Father?
No, my child. You have a long way to go. Now say an act of contrition. And remember, our Lord watches you every minute. God bless you, my child. First Communion Day is the happiest day of your life because of the collection and James Cagney at the Lyric Cinema. The night before, I was so excited I couldn't sleep till dawn. I'd still be sleeping if my grandmother hadn't come banging at the door.
Get up! Get up! Get that child out of the bed! Happiest day of his life and him snoring above in the bed!
I ran to the kitchen.
Take off that shirt, she said.
I took off the shirt and she pushed me into a tin tub of icy cold water. My mother scrubbed me, my grandmother scrubbed me. I was raw, I was red. They dried me. They dressed me in my black velvet First Communion suit with the white frilly shirt, the short pants, the white stockings, the black patent leather shoes. Around my arm they tied a white satin bow, and on my lapel they pinned the Sacred Heart of Jesus, a picture of the Sacred Heart, with blood dripping from it, flames erupting all around it, and on top a nasty-looking crown of thorns.
"Come here till I comb your hair," said Grandma. "Look at that mop, it won't lie down. You didn't get that hair from my side of the family. That's that North of Ireland hair you got from your father. That's the kind of hair you see on Presbyterians. If your mother had married a proper, decent Limerick man, you wouldn't have this standing up North of Ireland Presbyterian hair."
She spat twice on my head.
"Grandma, will you please stop spitting on my head?" "If you have anything to say, shut up. A little spit won't kill you. Come on, we'll be late for the Mass."
We ran to the church. My mother panted along behind with Michael in her arms. We arrived at the church just in time to see the last of the boys leaving the altar rail, where the priest stood with the chalice and the host, glaring at me. Then he placed on my tongue the wafer, the body and blood of Jesus. "At last, at last." It's on my tongue. I draw it back.
It stuck. I had God glued to the roof of my mouth. I could hear the Master's voice.
"Don't let that host touch your teeth, for if you bite God in two, you'll roast in hell for eternity."
I tried to get God down with my tongue, but the priest hissed at me.
"Stop that clucking and get back to your seat."
But God was good. He melted, and I swallowed him. And now at last I was a member of the true church, an official sinner. When the Mass ended, there they were at the door of the church, my mother with Michael in her arms, my grandmother. They each hugged me to their bosoms. They each told me it was the happiest day of my life. They each cried all over my head, and after my grandmother's contribution that morning, my head was a swamp.
"Ma'am, can I go now and make the collection?"
She said, "After you have a little breakfast."
"No," said Grandma. "You're not making no collection till you've had a proper First Communion breakfast at my house. Come on."
We followed her. She banged pots and rattled pans and complained that the whole world expected her to be at their beck and call. I ate the egg. I ate the sausage. And when I reached for more sugar for my tea, she slapped my hand away.
"Go easy with that sugar. Is it a millionaire you think I am? An American? Is it bedecked in glittering jewellery you think I am? Smothered in fancy furs?"
The food churned in my stomach. I gagged. I ran to her backyard and threw it all up. Out she came.
"Look at what he did. Thrown up his First Communion breakfast. thrown up the body and blood of Jesus. I have God in me backyard. What am I going to do?
I'll take him to the Jesuits, for they know the sins of the Pope himself. She dragged me through the streets of Limerick. She told the neighbours and passing strangers about God in her backyard. She pushed me into the confession box. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's a day since my last confession.
A day? And what sins have you committed in a day, my child?
I overslept. I nearly missed my first communion. My grandmother said I have standing up north of Ireland Presbyterian hair. I threw up my first communion breakfast. Now Grandma says she has God in her backyard, and what should she do?
The priest is like the first confession priest. He has the heavy breathing and the choking sounds.
Tell your grandmother to wash away God with a little water, and for your penance say one Hail Mary and one Our Father. Say a prayer for me and God bless you, my child.
Grandma and Mam were waiting close to the confession box. Grandma said,
Were you telling jokes to that priest in the confession box? If 'tis a thing I ever find out you were telling jokes to Jesuits, I'll tear the bloody kidneys out of you. Now what did he say about God in me backyard?
He said, Wash him away with a little water, Grandma.
Holy water or ordinary water?
He didn't say, Grandma.
Well, go back and ask him.
But Grandma...
She pushed me back into the confessional.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's a minute since my last confession.
A minute? Are you the boy that was just here?
I am, Father.
What is it now?
My grandmother says, Holy water or ordinary water?
Ordinary water, and tell your grandmother not to be bothering me again.
I told her, Ordinary water, Grandma, and he said, Don't be bothering him again.
Don't be bothering him again. That bloody ignorant bog trotter.
I asked Ma'am, Can I go now and make the collection? I want to see James Cagney.
Grandma said,
You could forget about the collection and James Cagney because you're not a proper Catholic the way you left God in the ground. Come on, go home.
Ma'am said, Wait a minute. That's my son. That's my son on his first communion day. He's going to see James Cagney.
No, he's not. Yes, he is.
Grandma said, Take him then to James Cagney and see if that will save his Presbyterian North of Ireland American soul. Go ahead. She pulled her shawl around her and walked away. Ma'am said, God, it's getting very late for the collection and you'll never see James Cagney. We'll go to the Lyric Cinema and see if they'll let you in anyway in your first communion suit. We met Mikey Malloy on Barrington Street. He asked if I was going to the Lyric and I said I was trying.
Trying?
He said, You don't have the money?
I was ashamed to say no, but I had to, and he said, That's all right, I'll get you in. I'll create a diversion.
What's a diversion?
I have the money to go. And when I get in, I'll pretend to have the fit, and the ticket man will be out of his mind, and you can slip in when I let out the big scream. I'll be watching the door, and when I see you in, I'll have a miraculous recovery. That's a diversion. That's what I do to get my brothers in all the time.
Ma'am said, Oh, I don't know about that, Mikey. Wouldn't that be a sin? And surely you wouldn't want Frank to commit a sin on his first communion day.
Mikey said, If there was a sin, it would be on his soul, and he wasn't a proper Catholic anyway, so it didn't matter. He let out his scream, and I slipped in and sat next to Question Quigley. And the ticket man, Frank Goggin, was so worried over Mikey he never noticed. It was a thrilling film, but sad in the end, because James Cagney was a public enemy, and when they shot him, they wrapped him in bandages and threw him in the door, shocking his poor old Irish mother. And that was the end of my first communion day.
Grandma won't talk to Mam any more because of what I did with God in her backyard. Mam doesn't talk to her sister Aunt Aggie or her brother Uncle Tom. Dad doesn't talk to anyone in Mam's family, and they don't talk to him because he's from the north and he has the odd manner. No one talks to Uncle Tom's wife, Jane, because she's from Galway and she has the look of a Spaniard. Everyone talks to Mam's brother, Uncle Pat, because he was dropped on his head, he's simple, and he sells newspapers. Everyone calls him the Abbot, or Ab Sheehan, and no one knows why. Everyone talks to Uncle Pat Keating, because he was gassed in the war and married Aunt Aggie. And if they didn't talk to him, he wouldn't give a fiddler's fart anyway. And that's why the men in South's pub call him a gas man. That's the way I'd like to be in the world, a gas man, not giving a fiddler's fart. And that's what I tell the angel on the seventh step, till I remember, you're not supposed to say fart in the presence of an angel. Uncle Tom and Galway Jane have children, but we're not supposed to talk to them because our parents are not talking. They have a son and daughter, Jerry and Peggy, and Mam will yell at us for talking to them, but we don't know how not to talk to our cousins. People in families in the lanes of Limerick have their ways of not talking to each other, and it takes years of practice. There are people who don't talk to each other because their fathers were on opposite sides in the Civil War in 1922. If a man goes off and joins the English army, his family might as well move to another part of Limerick where there are families with men in the English army. If anyone in your family was the least way friendly to the English in the last 800 years, it would be brought up and thrown in your face, and you might as well move to Dublin where no one cares. There are families that are ashamed of themselves because their forefathers gave up their religion for the sake of a bowl of Protestant soup during the famine, and those families are known ever after as supers. It's a terrible thing to be a super, because you're doomed forever to the super part of hell. It's even worse to be an informer. The master at school said that every time the Irish were about to demolish the English in a fair fight, a filthy informer betrayed them. A man who's discovered to be an informer deserves to be hanged, or even worse, to have no one talk to him, for if no one talks to you, you're better off hanging at the end of a rope. In every lane, there's always someone not talking to someone, or everyone not talking to someone, or someone not talking to everyone. You can always tell when people are not talking by the way they pass each other. The women hoist their noses, tighten their mouths, and turn their faces away. If the woman is wearing a shawl, she takes a corner and flings it over her shoulder as if to say, "One word or look from you, you mad-faced bitch, and I'll tear the countenance from the front of your head." It's bad when Grandma won't talk to us, because we can't run to her when we need to borrow sugar or tea or milk. There's no use going to Aunt Aggie. She'll only bite your head off. "Go home," she'll say, "and tell your father get off his northern arse and get a job like the decent men of Limerick." They say she's always angry because she has red hair, or she has red hair because she's always angry. Mam is friendly with Bridie Hannon, who lives next door with her mother and father. Mam and Bridie talk all the time. When my father goes for his long walk, Bridie comes in and she and Mam sit by the fire drinking tea and smoking cigarettes. If Mam has nothing in the house, Bridie brings tea, sugar and milk. Sometimes they use the same tea leaves over and over, and Mam says the tea is stewed, coddled and boiled. Mam and Bridie sit so close to the fire their shins turn red and purple and blue. They talk for hours and they whisper and laugh over secret things. We're not supposed to hear the secret things, so we're told go out and play. I often sit on the seventh step listening, and they have no notion I'm there. It might be lashing rain out, but Mam says, "Rain or no, out you go." And she'll tell us,
If you see your father coming, run in and tell me.
Ma'am says to Bridie, did you ever hear that poem that someone must have made up about me and him?
What poem, Angela?
'Tis called The Man from the North. I got this poem from Minnie McAdory in America.
I never heard that poem. Say it for me.
Ma'am says the poem, but she laughs all through it, and I don't know why.
He came from the north, so his words were few, but his voice was kind and his heart was true, and I knew by his eyes that no guile had he, so I married my man from the north country. Oh, Gary Owen may be more gay than this quiet man from beside Loch Ness, and I know that the sun shines softly down on the river that runs through my native town. But there's not, and I say it with joy and with pride, a better man in all Munster wide, and Limerick town has no happier hearth than mine has been with my man from the north. I wish that in Limerick they only knew the kind neighbours I came unto. Small hate or scorn would there ever be between the south and the north country. She always repeats the third verse and laughs so hard she's crying, and I don't know why. She goes into hysterics when she says, and Limerick town has no happier hearth than mine has been with my man from the north. If he comes back early and sees Bridie in the kitchen, the man from the north says, gossip, 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 and stands there with his cap on till she leaves. Bridie's mother, and other people in our lane and lanes beyond, will come to the door to ask Dad if he'll write a letter to the government, or a relation in a distant place. He sits at the table with his pen and bottle of ink, and when the people tell him what to write, he says, ach no, that's not what you want to say. And he writes what he feels like writing. The people tell him that's what they wanted to say in the first place, that he has a lovely way with the English language and a fine fist for the writing. They offer him sixpence for his trouble, but he waves it away and they hand it to Ma'am, because he's too grand to be taking sixpence. When the people leave, he takes the sixpence and sends me to Kathleen O'Connell's shop for cigarettes. Grandma sleeps in a big bed upstairs with a picture of the Sacred Heart of Jesus over her head and a statue of the Sacred Heart on the mantelpiece. She wants to switch from gas light to electric light someday so that she'll have a little red light under the statue forever. Her devotion to the Sacred Heart is known up and down the lane and in lanes beyond. Uncle Pat sleeps in a small bed in a corner of the room where Grandma can make sure he comes in at a proper hour, and kneels by the bed to say his prayers. He might have been dropped in his head. He may not know how to read and write. He may drink one pint too many, but there's no excuse for not saying his prayers before he goes to sleep. Uncle Pat tells Grandma he met a man who's looking for a place to stay that will let him wash himself morning and night and give him two meals a day, dinner and tea. His name is Bill Galvin, and he has a good job down at the lime kiln. He's covered all the time with white lime dust, but surely that's better than coal dust. Grandma will have to give up her bed and move into the small room. She'll take the Sacred Heart picture and leave the statue to watch over the two men. Besides, she has no place for a statue in her little room. Bill Galvin comes after work to see the place. He's small, all white, and he snuffles like a dog. He asked Grandma if she'd mind taking down the statue because he's a Protestant and he wouldn't be able to sleep. Grandma barks at Uncle Pat for not telling her he was dragging a Protestant into the house. Jesus, she says, there will be gossip up and down the lane and beyond. Uncle Pat says he didn't know Bill Galvin was a Protestant. You could never tell by looking at him, especially the way he's covered with lime. He looks like an ordinary Catholic, and you'd never imagine a Protestant would be shoveling lime. Bill Galvin says his poor wife that just died was a Catholic, and she had the walls covered with pictures of the Sacred Heart and the Virgin Mary showing their hearts.
He's not against the Sacred Heart himself. It's just that seeing the statue will remind him of his poor wife and give him the heartache. Grandma says, "Ah, God help us. Why didn't you tell me that in the first place? Sure, I could put the statue on the windowsill in my room, and your heart won't be tormented at the sight of it." Every morning, Grandma cooks Bill's dinner and takes it to him at the lime kiln. Mam wonders why he can't take it with him in the morning, and Grandma says, "Do you expect me to get up at dawn and boil cabbage and pig's toes for his lordship to take in his dinner can?" Mam tells her, "In another week school will be over, and if you give Frank sixpence a week, he'll surely be glad to take Bill Galvin his dinner." I don't want to go to Grandma's every day. I don't want to take Bill Galvin his dinner all the way down the dock road. But Mam says, "That's sixpence we could use, and if I don't do it, I'm going nowhere else." "You're staying in the house," she says. "You're not playing with your pals." Grandma warns me to take the dinner can directly and not be meandering, looking this way and that, kicking canisters and ruining the toes of my shoes. "This dinner is hot, and that's the way Bill Galvin wants it." There's a lovely smell from the dinner can, boiled bacon and cabbage and two big floury white potatoes. Surely he won't notice if I try half a potato. He won't complain to Grandma, because he hardly ever talks outside of a snuffle or two. It's better if I eat the other half potato, so that he won't be asking why he got a half. I might as well try the bacon and cabbage too, and if I eat the other potato, he'd surely think she didn't send one at all. The second potato melts in my mouth, and I'll have to try another bit of cabbage, another morsel of bacon. There isn't much left now, and he'll be very suspicious, so I might as well finish off the rest. What am I going to do now? Grandma will destroy me, Mam will keep me in for a year, Bill Galvin will bury me in lime. I'll tell him I was attacked by a dog in the dock road, and he ate the whole dinner, and I'm lucky I escaped without being eaten myself. "Oh, is that so?" says Bill Galvin. "And what's that bit of cabbage hanging on your gansy? Did the dog lick you with his cabbagey gob? Go home and tell your grandmother you ate me whole dinner, and I'm falling down with the hunger in this lime kiln." "She'll kill me." "Tell her don't kill you till she sends me some class of a dinner, and if you don't go to her now and get me a dinner, I'll kill you and throw your body into the lime there, and there won't be much left for your mother to moan over." Grandma says, "What are you doing back with that can? He could bring that back by himself." "He wants more dinner." "What do you mean, more dinner? Jesus above, is there a hole he has in his leg?" "He's fallen down with the hunger below in the lime kiln." "Is it cotton me you are? He says send him any class of a dinner." "I will not. I sent him his dinner." "He didn't get it." "He didn't. Why not?" "I ate it." "What?" "I was hungry, and I tasted it, and I couldn't stop." "Jesus, Mary, and Holy St. Joseph." She gives me a clout in the head that brings tears to my eyes. She screams at me like a banshee and jumps around the kitchen and threatens to drag me to the priest, the bishop, the pope himself if he lived around the corner. She cuts bread and waves the knife at me and makes sandwiches of brawn and cold potatoes. "Take these sandwiches to Bill Galvin, and if you even look cross-eyed at them, I'll skin your hide." Of course she runs to Mam, and they agree the only way I can make up for my terrible sin is to deliver Bill Galvin's dinner for a fortnight without pay. I'm to bring back the can every day, and that means I have to sit watching him stuff the food into his gob, and he's not one that would ever ask you if you had a mouth in your head. Every day I take the can back, Grandma makes me kneel to the statue of the Sacred Heart and tell him I'm sorry. And all this over Bill Galvin, a Protestant. Mam says, "I'm a martyr for the fags, and so is your father. There may be a lack of tea or bread in the house, but Mam and Dad always manage to get the fags, the wild woodbines. They have to have the woodbines in the morning, and any time they drink tea. They tell us every day we should never smoke. It's bad for your lungs, it's bad for your chest, it stunts your growth. And they sit by the fire puffing away. Mam says, "If tis a thing I ever see you with a fag in your gob, I'll break your face." They tell us the cigarettes rot your teeth, and you can see they're not lying. The teeth turn brown and black in their heads and fall out one by one. Dad says he has holes in his teeth big enough for a sparrow to raise a family. He has a few left, but he gets them pulled at the clinic and applies for a false set. When he comes home with the new teeth, he shows his big new white smile that makes him look like an American. And whenever he tells us a ghost story by the fire, he pushes the lower teeth up beyond his lip to his nose and frightens the life out of us. Mam's teeth are so bad, she has to go to Barrington's hospital to have them all pulled at the same time. And when she comes home, she's holding at her mouth a rag bright with blood. She has to sit up all night by the fire, because you can't lie down when your gums are pumping blood, or you'll choke in your sleep. She says she'll give up smoking entirely when this bleeding stops, but she needs one puff of a fag this minute for the comfort that's in it. She tells Malachy, go to Kathleen O'Connell's shop and ask her would she ever let her have 5 woodbines till Dad collects the doll on Thursday. If anyone could get the fags out of Kathleen, Malachy can. Mam says he has the charm, and she tells me, there's no use sending you with your long puss and your father's odd manner. When the bleeding stops and Mam's gums heal, she goes to the clinic for her false teeth. She says she'll give up the smoking when her new teeth are in, but she never does. The new teeth rub on her gums and make them sore, and the smoke of the woodbines eases them. She and Dad sit by the fire when we have one and smoke their cigarettes, and when they talk, their teeth clack. They try to stop the clacking by moving their jaws back and forth. But that only makes it worse, and they curse the dentists and the people above in Dublin who made the teeth, and while they curse, they clack. Dad claims these teeth were made for rich people in Dublin and didn't fit, so they were passed on to the poor of Limerick, who don't care, because you don't have much to chew when you're poor anyway, and you're grateful you have any class of a tooth in your head. If they talk too long, their gums get sore, and the teeth have to come out. Then they sit talking by the fire with their faces collapsed. Every night they leave the teeth in the kitchen in jam jars filled with water. Malachy wants to know why, and Dad tells him it cleans them. Mam says, no, you can't have teeth in your head while you're sleeping, for they'll slip and choke you to death entirely. The teeth are the cause of Malachy going to Barrington's hospital and me having an operation. Malachy whispers to me in the middle of the night, do you want to go downstairs and see if we can wear the teeth? The teeth are so big we have trouble getting them into our mouths, but Malachy won't give up. He forces Dad's upper teeth into his mouth and can't get them out again. His lips are drawn back and the teeth make a big grin. He looks like a monster in a film and it makes me laugh, but he pulls at them and grunts, uck, uck, and tears come to his eyes. The more he goes, uck, uck, the harder I laugh, till Dad calls from upstairs, what are you boys doing? Malachy runs from me, up the stairs, and now I hear Dad and Mam laughing, till they see he can choke on the teeth. They both stick their fingers in to pull out the teeth, but Malachy gets frightened and makes desperate uck uck sounds. Mam says, we'll have to take him to the hospital. And Dad says, he'll take him. He makes me go, in case the doctor has questions, because I'm older than Malachy, and that means I must have started all the trouble. Dad rushes through the streets with Malachy in his arms, and I try to keep up. I feel sorry for Malachy, up there on Dad's shoulder, looking back at me, tears on his cheeks and Dad's teeth bulging in his mouth. The doctor at Barrington's hospital says, no bother. He pours oil into Malachy's mouth and has the teeth out in a minute. Then he looks at me and says to Dad, "Why is that child standing there with his mouth hanging open?" Dad says, "That's a habit he has, standing with his mouth open." The doctor says, "Come here to me." He looks up my nose, in my ears, down my throat, and feels my neck. "The tonsils," he says, "the adenoids. They have to come out. The sooner the better, or he'll look like an idiot when he grows up with that gob wide as a boot." Next day, Maliki gets a big piece of toffee as a reward for sticking in teeth he can't get out, and I have to go to the hospital to have an operation that would close my mouth. On a Saturday morning, Mam finishes her tea and says, "You're going to dance."
"Dance? Why?"
"You're 7 years old, you made your first communion, and now 'tis time for the dancing. I'm taking you down to Catherine Street to Mrs. O'Connor's Irish dancing classes. You'll go there every Saturday morning, and that'll keep you off the streets. That'll keep you from wandering around Limerick with hooligans." She tells me, "Wash my face, not forgetting ears and neck. Comb my hair, blow my nose, take the look off my face." "What look? Never mind, just take it off. Put on my stockings and my first communion shoes, which," she says, "are destroyed because I can't pass a canister or a rock without kicking it." She's worn out standing in the queue at the St. Vincent de Paul Society, begging for boots for me and Maliki, so that we can wear out the toes with the kicking. Your father says it's never too early to learn the songs and dances of your ancestors.
"What's ancestors?"
"Never mind," she says. "You're going to dance." I wonder how I can die for Ireland if I have to sing and dance for Ireland too. I wonder why they never say, "Oh, you can eat sweets and stay home from school and go swimming for Ireland." Mam says, "Don't get smart or I'll warm your ear." Cyril Benson dances. He has medals hanging from his shoulders to his kneecaps. He wins contests all over Ireland, and he looks lovely in his saffron kilt. He's a credit to his mother, and he gets his name in the paper all the time, and you could be sure he brings home the odd few pounds. You don't see him roaming the streets, kicking everything in sight till the toes hang out of his boots. Oh, no, he's a good boy, dancing for his poor mother. Mam wets an old towel and scrubs my face till it stings. She wraps the towel around her finger and sticks it in my ears and claims there's enough wax there to grow potatoes. She wets my hair to make it lie down. She tells me, "Shut up and stop the whinging, that these dancing lessons will cost her sixpence every Saturday, which I could have earned bringing Bill Galvin his dinner, and God knows she can barely afford it." I tried to tell her, "Ah, ma'am, sure you don't have to send me to dancing school when you could be smoking a nice woodbine and having a cup of tea." But she says, "Oh, aren't you clever? You're going to dance if I have to give up the fags forever." If my pals see my mother dragging me through the streets to an Irish dancing class, I'll be disgraced entirely. They think it's all right to dance and pretend you're Fred Astaire because you can jump all over the screen with Ginger Rogers. There's no Ginger Rogers in Irish dancing, and you can't jump all over. You stand straight up and down and keep your arms against yourself and kick your legs up and around and never smile. My uncle Pat Keating said, "Irish dancers look like they have steel rods up their arses." But I can't say that to Mam. She'd kill me. There's a gramophone in Mrs. O'Connor's playing an Irish jig or a reel, and boys and girls are dancing around, kicking their legs out and keeping their hands to their sides. Mrs. O'Connor is a great fat woman, and when she stops the record to show the steps, all the fat from her chin to her ankles jiggles. And I wonder how she can teach the dancing. She comes over to my mother and says,
"So, this is little Frankie. I think we have the makings of a dancer here. Boys and girls, do we have the makings of a dancer here?" "We do, Mrs. O'Connor."
Mam says, "I have the sixpence, Mrs. O'Connor."
"Ah, yes, Mrs. McCourt, hold on a minute."
She waddles to a table and brings back the head of a black boy with kinky hair, big eyes, huge red lips, and an open mouth. She tells me, put the sixpence in the mouth and take my hand out before the black boy bites me. All the boys and girls watch and they have little smiles. I drop in the sixpence and pull my hand back before the mouth snaps shut. Everyone laughs, and I know they wanted to see my hand caught in the mouth. Mrs. O'Connor gasps and laughs and says to my mother, isn't that a howl now? Ma'am says it's a howl. She tells me, behave myself and come home dancing. I don't want to stay in this place where Mrs. O'Connor can't take the sixpence herself instead of letting me nearly lose my hand in the black boy's mouth. I don't want to stay in this place where you have to stand in line with boys and girls, straighten your back, hands by your sides, look ahead, don't look down, move your feet, look at Cyril, and there goes Cyril, all dressed up in his saffron kilt and the medals jingling, medals for this and medals for that. And the girls love Cyril, and Mrs. O'Connor loves Cyril, for didn't he bring her fame, and didn't she teach him every step he knows? Oh, dance, Cyril, dance. Oh, Jesus, he floats around the room. He's an angel out of heaven. And stop the frowning Frankie McCourt, or you'll have a puss on you like a pound of tripe. Dance, Frankie, dance. Pick up your feet for the love of Jesus. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3. Mara, will you help that Frankie McCourt before he ties his 2 feet around his pole entirely? Help him, Mara. Mara is the big girl, about 10. She dances up to me with her white teeth and her dancers dressed with all the gold and yellow and green figures that are supposed to come from olden times, and she says, give me your hand, little boy. And she wheels me around the room till I'm dizzy and making a pure idiot of myself and blushing and foolish till I want to cry. But I'm saved when the record stops and the gramophone goes whoosh, whoosh. Mrs. O'Connor says, oh, thank you, Mara. And next week, Cyril, you can show Frankie a few of the steps that made you famous. Next week, boys and girls, and don't forget the sixpence for the little black boy. Boys and girls leave together. I make my own way down the stairs and out the door, hoping my pals won't see me with boys who wear kilts and girls with white teeth and fancy dresses from olden times. Mam is having tea with Bridie Hannon, her friend from next door. Mam says, well, what did you learn? It makes me dance around the kitchen. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3. She has a good laugh with Bridie. That's not too bad for your first time. In a month, you'll be like a regular Cyril Benson. I don't want to be Cyril Benson. I want to be Fred Astaire. They turn hysterical, laughing and squirting tea out of their mouths. Jesus love him, says Bridie. Doesn't he have a great notion of himself? Fred Astaire, how are you? Mam says Fred Astaire went to his lessons every Saturday and didn't go around kicking the toes out of his boots. And if I wanted to be like him, I'd have to go to Mrs. O'Connor's every week. The fourth Saturday morning, Billy Campbell knocks at our door. Mrs. McCourt, can Frankie come out and play? Mam tells him, no, Billy, Frankie is going to his dancing lesson. He waits for me at the bottom of Barrack Hill. He wants to know why I'm dancing. That everyone knows dancing is a sissy thing, and I'll wind up like Cyril Benson wearing a kilt and medals and dancing all over with girls. He says next thing I'll be sitting in the kitchen knitting socks. He says dancing will destroy me, and I won't be fit to play any kind of football, soccer, rugby, or Gaelic football itself, because the dancing teaches you to run like a sissy and everyone will laugh. I tell him I'm finished with the dancing, that I have sixpence in my pocket from Mrs. O'Connor that's supposed to go into the black boy's mouth, that I'm going to the Lyric Cinema instead. Sixpence will get the two of us in, with tuppence left over for 2 squares of Cleve's toffee, and we have a great time looking at Riders of the Purple Sage. Dad is sitting by the fire with Mam, and they want to know what steps I learned today and what they're called. I already did the Siege of Ennis and the Walls of Limerick, which are real dances. Now I have to make up names and dances. Mam says she never heard of a dance called the Siege of Dingle. But if that's what I learn, go ahead, dance it. And I dance around the kitchen with my hands down by my sides, making my own music. Diddly idle doodle da diddly idle doodle da. Dad and Mam clapping in time with my feet. Dad says, "Ach, that's a fine dance. And you'll be a powerful Irish dancer and a credit to the men who died for their country." Mam says, "That wasn't much for a sixpence." Next week, it's a George Raft film, and the week after that, a cowboy film with George O'Brien. Then, it's James Cagney, and I can't take Billy because I want to get a bar of chocolate to go with my Cleves toffee. And I'm having a great time till there's a terrible pain in my jaw, and it's a tooth out of my gum stuck in my toffee, and the pain is killing me. Still, I can't waste the toffee, so I pull out the tooth and put it in my pocket and chew the toffee on the other side of my mouth, blood and all. There's pain on one side and delicious toffee on the other, and I remember what my Uncle Pat Keating would say. There are times when you wouldn't know whether to shit or go blind. I have to go home now and worry, because you can't go through the world short a tooth without your mother knowing. Mothers know everything, and she's always looking into our mouths to see if there's any class of disease. She's there by the fire, and Dad is there, and they're asking me the same old questions, the dance and the name of the dance. I tell them I learned the Waltz of Cork, and I dance around the kitchen trying to hum a made-up tune, and dying with the pain of my tooth. Mam says, "Waltz of Cork, my eye, there's no such dance," and Dad says, "Come over here. Stand there before me. Tell us the truth. Did you go to your dancing classes today?" I can't tell a lie anymore because my gum is killing me and there's blood in my mouth. Besides, I know they know everything, and that's what they're telling me now. Some snake of a boy from the dancing school saw me going to the Lyric Cinema and told. And Mrs. O'Connor sent a note to say she hadn't seen me in ages, and was I all right, because I had great promise and could follow in the footsteps of the great Cyril Benson. Dad doesn't care about my tooth or anything. He says I'm going to confession and drags me over to the Redemptorist Church because it's Saturday and confessions go on all day. He tells me I'm a bad boy. He's ashamed of me, that I went to the pictures instead of learning Ireland's national dances, the jig, the reel, the dances that men and women fought and died for down these sad centuries. He says there's many a young man that was hanged and now mouldering in a lime pit that would be glad to rise up and dance the Irish dance. The priest is old, and I have to yell my sins at him. And he tells me I'm a hooligan for going to the pictures instead of my dancing lessons, although he thinks himself that dancing is a dangerous thing, almost as bad as the films, that it stirs up thoughts sinful in themselves. But even if dancing is an abomination, I sinned by taking my mother's sixpence and lying, and there's a hot place in hell for the likes of me. Say a decade of the rosary and ask God's forgiveness, for you're dancing at the gates of hell itself, child. I'm 7, 8, 9, going on 10, and still Dad has no work. He drinks his tea in the morning, signs for the dole at the Labour Exchange, reads the papers at the Carnegie Library, goes for his long walks far into the country. If he gets a job at the Limerick Cement Company or Rank's Flour Mills, he loses it in the third week. He loses it because he goes to the pubs on the third Friday of the job, drinks all his wages, and misses the half day of work on Saturday morning. Mam says, "Why can't he be like the other men from the lanes of Limerick? They're home before the Angelus rings at 6 o'clock. They hand over their wages, change their shirts, have their tea, get a few shillings from the wife, and they're off to the pub for a pint or two." Mam tells Bridie Hannon that Dad can't be like that and won't be like that. She says he's a right bloody fool, the way he goes to pubs and stands pints to other men, while his own children are home with their bellies stuck to their backbones for the want of a decent dinner. He'll brag to the world he did his bit for Ireland when it was neither popular nor profitable.
that he'll gladly die for Ireland when the call comes, that he regrets he has only one life to give for his poor, misfortunate country, and if anyone